Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 804, May the 4th, 1987. Our would-be king and queen are falling apart in front of our eyes in the White House. He has much further to fall than any president of the United States. Ronald Reagan was put together by J. Walter Thompson and the Hollywood studios that made the movies that told you to go to war, to go off to war. It's hard to hold that kind of image together forever. Reagan's so far out of contact with reality that the front page of the newspapers across the country today quoted him as saying that he wanted to return democracy to Nicaragua. When did Nicaragua have democracy after the Spanish discovered it and after the Americans got there? Reagan sincerely believes that the Shahs of Iran or the Savak or the Somoza Army are the democracies of Iran and Nicaragua, and when he works to put in the democracies, he can't separate fascism from democracy. The fate of the king and queen in our United States, the would-be king and queen, came apart with exposures of Alfred Bloomingdale, that's a gentleman that Reagan put on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and he and Betsy were two of the president and his wife's closest friends. The social life in Washington was pretty high fashion with a lot of borrowed jewelry and beaded dresses. And then all of a sudden we learned about the kinky sex, the sadomasochism, the group sex, the chains, the whips, the mistresses. And some of this is allegedly on videotapes. And after that point, the Reagans went off to Camp David every Friday and returned on Sunday. And that about ended their social life. They've somewhat been in seclusion except for a few state dinners, and they're not very often. Alfred Bloomingdale, at the time all of this was going on, of course, was in a position appointed by the president to the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. One of the members of that board was Roy Cohn. He was also on the board of Western Goals and the first person from the administration to die of AIDS. Bloomingdale's mistress, Vicky Morgan, lived with him, and at the same time she shared a home with Bernie Cornfield. And Bernie Cornfield's investment overseas and his partner to Robert Fesco set up the banking network by which the Iran-Contra gate people got involved. And I'll go into that a little more of that in a moment. So Bloomingdale was tied in early to these banking schemes and through his joint mistress with Cornfield. And the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board has used these offshore banking teams that they inherited from the administration before and the one before. But Reagan took it to the ultimate. The saddest thing about Reagan's life as all this comes down and the gavel goes down tomorrow on the hearings that begin the hearings was the sad story of his son, Michael, telling about being molested for 1 year by a scout advisor and coming forward at this time. Their life is, I'm sure, a personal tragedy, all of them. And the tragedy that's the worst of all is, first of all, pretending, and the second of all, imposing the mentality that they had, which was cruel and vindictive and not able to see what other people feel or think. And Reagan never changed. He had that same attitude in California and the same for the corporations he worked for, like General Electric and so forth. There is an author, a professor, who I've read at various times, Herbert Mueller, and his subject that he particularly has studied is freedom. And he's interested, he's written a book, Freedom in the Modern World, Freedom from Religion or with Religion, Freedom in the Western World, The Issues of Freedom, The Loom of History, The Spirit of Tragedy, The Uses of the Past. Those are titles of his books on how do you stay free. And we were almost losing a lot of our collective freedom under this administration, as other countries have, as Reagan planned 60 covert operations to overthrow 60 different countries, and we don't have to enumerate them now to see the things that he's done. But in this book, Herbert Mueller talks about the Versailles Treaty and the sad death, the demise of Woodrow Wilson. And there's a similarity in this book to the tragedies that are taking place now with Irangate, and I just want to share a few sentences. He said there was a little question about the moral grandeur of Woodrow Wilson. He said he was the only leading statesman at Paris who was disinterested and unselfish. He wasn't seeking anything for his own nation. He was devoted wholly to the cause of world peace, and he was the only one whose failure may be called a great failure because of the inability to hold the peace. The hardest working of the statesman, too, of all the statesmen, he had always constantly to be assailed by national greed and hatred. And this author tells how Wilson had a lot of faults, and he enumerates them, but he also had the vision of hope, and he did hope that something like the League of Nations, he said, was the only hope of mankind. It may be frail. There's no other way to assure the peace. And he said, I can predict with absolute certainty that within another generation there will be another world war if the nations of the world do not concert the methods by which to prevent it. He said that America, again, will be fighting, pardon me, fighting Germany on the same battlegrounds, which they did with the same allies. And the conclusion of this author about Wilson's era, going to the next one, he said, at the end, Wilson attacked the idea of the disenchanted that he had to deal with. He said and believed the world is run by ideals, and only the fools think otherwise, that ideals are really the most important thing to live by. And then after Wilson died, Mr. Mueller continues, by the time the fools had taken over America with the aid of shoddier ideals, the Republican bosses picked out Senator Harding to serve as their front in taking over government. A folksy, small-town nonentity, which is like Reagan, comfortably ignorant of the world, always at home with platitudes, Harding was an ideal puppet. He demanded nothing of the people, assuring them that the present need was not heroics but healing, promising a return to normalcy, whatever that is, the good old days of business as usual, and the voters responded by giving him an overwhelming popular majority. By general consent, the worst president of the country has ever had, he was presumably just the kind of man that they deserved. In any case, he inaugurated the most inglorious decade in the nation's history. Now, we see this happening with Ronald Reagan coming in as president, and he is inaugurating or has inaugurated the most horrible era of American history that we'll have to undo for years to come. As a matter of fact, there was an article in the L.A. Times. It's written by James Michener, who's a staunch Republican and was gung-ho for Reagan all the way. The article is titled, You Can Call the 1980s the Ugly Decade, the Uglies Decade. And he was part of the system who went for the platitudes, who went for this non-entity, who agreed to put him in that all we need is healing. What was the healing? The murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, John Lennon, Frank Church, Senator Philip Hart, Olaf Palme, Ralph Bunche, Dag Hammarskjöld, Salvador Allende, Mr. Bhutto in Pakistan, Maurice Bishop in Grenada, Reagan knocked him off and wanted to kill Gaddafi. Kent State, all of these preceded, and in comes Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and they are going to do away with the ideals. They're pragmatic. They know how to deal, mixing the Vatican, the Moonies, the Mafia, the secret teams, the National Security Council, the Brzezinskis, the Kissingers. They're going to do it all themselves. They're going to make the world the way they want it, and Congress is supposed to sit by and take it. Ideals die hard, or do they die at all? And was Woodrow Wilson correct when he said the world is run by ideals? The answer to that question isn't in yet. I don't have the answer. But, however, we do have the pleasure of observing, starting tomorrow, May the 5th, 1987, some of the sleaziest, the cruelest, the most corrupt manipulators of human history. They will be exposed in some fashion, not totally, but in some fashion. And most will get pardons. All will become millionaires. Books, movies, so what? It doesn't matter what their rewards are. Watergate became a word, a meaning. Iran, Contra, Gate, however you want to term this, it's Reagan's turn to do the things he always dreamed of doing, which were manipulation. That was his dream. And now he has to see those pieces shattered like broken glass, and they've been coming apart since last October. There's high drama in the nation this week. The high drama is going around the world. The hearings start, and this whole thing begins to, not all of it, but pieces get unglued publicly with the massive television videotapes before Senate Select Committees. They're going to locate and identify some of the methods by which Ronald Reagan circumvented Congress, the official Defense Department, the Secretary of State. He passed up existing agencies that were provided to safeguard our liberties. Reagan wasn't the first person to do this. He wasn't the first person to use the National Security Council like that. I think that you can thank Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger for turning that agency into what it became, and certainly after World War II, when it was formed in 1947. But we are going on to the next chapter of history, not to the past, and he was caught, and therefore he must, in effect, stand trial, and that's what these hearings are about. This is Reagan's private army, who will be given certain rewards to tell how Reagan operated, and don't believe for a minute that he wasn't a hand-on president and didn't know every single thing he did. He couldn't have run California like that for 8 years and then lost the ability to hold it together because he's the same man he was in Washington that he was in California. Now, it's seldom in one's lifetime, and I'm talking about myself and other researchers in particular, that we get are lucky enough to see these things unfold before our eyes. And I mentioned this before, but not only our eyes, things that we've seen for eyes only are on that wide screen now taped for history. For 24 years, I've researched murders and criminals in Washington, and starting May 17th of this year, it'll be my 17th year on the air. And pardon me, June 17th, I believe it was when the Pentagon Papers broke. Now, congressional hearings such as this never uncover the whole truth. At the end of the Watergate hearings, I published within that year, the Senate Select Committee is part of the cover-up, but it gave you a good enough view to have building blocks to understand why this is happening now, and that's the main thing. Raw nerves are exposed, connecting tissues are open. It's hard to put them back. Like John Ehrlichman said, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. And along these lines of being an investigator and being able to see these things unfold in front of me, as well as my coworkers, and I do believe in synchronicity, I got a package this week that made me very happy and made me realize that these 23 years of research and 16 years on the air, I know they have a value, but it isn't always, again, in your lifetime that you can get your peer group to understand what you're doing. And this week I got a book from George Seldes. It's an autographed book. His most recent book, George Seldes, is now 97 years old. It's called A Witness to History, Encounters with the Noted, the Notorious, and the Three SOBs, published by Ballantine. And I want to share with you what he wrote inside the book and what I wrote back to him and with the people who sent this to me, because it's pertinent that George Seldes was exposing these very people, the DuPonts, the Morgans, the Mellons, the causes that would become World War II. He had a newsletter, a small newsletter called In Fact, and I have all four volumes bound together. But he was doing something, you know, very heroic for his time and still is, naming the people that were causing so much pain and hardship on people who were to die, to be tortured, to be moved around as immigrants, and he was trying to expose what was happening. And fortunately, he has lived through this whole cycle. I haven't been doing it as long as he has, but he has lived to see how these kings do fall and how their mischief really tangles the whole world, and every time they get into a ball of wax, it brings in more people until we have real crises in this country and around the world. Now, in the book, front page, he autographed it to Mae Brussel, the American Appassionaria, this gift from Lud Ahrens. Lud Ahrens is a fellow researcher and a mutual friend of George Seldes, who went and took a picture of Seldes autographing the book and sent me the book, and he said, this is from the Society of Journalists, also best wishes, George Seldes, April 26, 1987. And the front page of the book is open, and Lud Ahrens took a picture of him signing it to Mae Brussel. And this was one of the happiest treasures I have received in the 23 years of research. And with it came a letter from the Society of Journalists, signed by Michael Conway, a friend and associate of George Seldes, sending the book and writing to me. And he said, Dear Mae Brussel, the Awards Committee of the Society of Journalists takes great pleasure of informing you that you have been voted the winner of the George Seldes Award for Relevant Journalism for 1987 for work that you accomplished in 1986. In addition, the committee wishes to cite you for your consistent devotion to reporting the hard stories that have been neglected by so many others. Your unflinching courage, determination, and single-minded dedication to your purpose of airing the most vital news necessary to create a more rational society is also recognized and lauded by the society. This letter has been typed on George Selde's 1937 Royal, which has typed many of his most noted manuscripts. Congratulations and many good wishes to continue your most crucial work. And I answered back and said, "Dear George, your autographed book, Witness to a Century, and the picture Lud Ahrens took of you arrived yesterday. I can't think of anything that has happened to me in 23 years research, doing 16 years on the air, that has made me more proud and happy. You are the master genius whose examples of honesty, disgust of fascism, inspires people like me to do our work. I took a picture of my special place where I keep your books and will send it to you when the role is developed. My collection includes, and these are the books that I have that he's written, You Can't Print That, Can These Things Be, Sawdust Caesar, Lords of the Press, The Catholic Crisis, Facts and Fascism, 1,000 Americans, The People Don't Know, Tell the Truth and Run, Never Tire Protesting, In Fact, Great Thoughts, Even the Gods Can't Change History, and In Fact, I have 4 volumes of his newsletter, 1945 to 1950. I concluded, what can I say to you except thank you very, very much. I'm dedicated to my research, and I know the information is valuable and important. However, it isn't very often that someone so courageous as you, who has consistently known the enemy and identified them, is able to come forward as you did to hopefully inspire me for as many years as you have enjoyed. My 65th birthday is this month. Did you feel like 40 when you were 65? And he's 97 now. Maybe the amount of years doesn't matter when you're doing the right thing. It agreed with you, and it certainly does with me. Please thank Michael Conway and Lud Ahrens for their wonderful letter and book and photographs of you. These will be framed on my wall. And in conjunction with the Contragate hearings coming down and proceeding tomorrow, I talked with Don Fried this morning. Don Fried wrote a brilliant book on Ronald Reagan called The Secret Life of Ronald Reagan. It was published in 1984, immediately locked up and suppressed. But Don's books and his plays are identical to George Selde's. His life is a testament to continuous struggle to expose fascism, twisted minds that torture and kill, and expose high authorities who employ killers to do their work. It was Don Fried who set up the press conference at L.A. Press Club for me when I came out with my article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, that detailed all the connecting links, the major connecting links at the time of Watergate, and it was printed in The Realist in 1972, in the summer of 72. We both agreed on the telephone we'd hold a drink, although I don't drink hard stuff, and we'd toast the people we know and that we appreciate who were never fooled by the likes of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. You know, there'll be approximately 200 books on Reagan, but this was a lonely fight, for a long, long time. The books will flow now, and they'll go to the computers, and they'll look up his past and every rotten thing about him. And yet the authors will not admit that most of them were part of the problem because they refused to expose Ronald Reagan when he announced he was going to be president of the United States, or wanted to be. There were several other people that had worked continuously on these deep roots of fascism that Reagan was galloping towards. One who's done a monumental job is Peter Dale Scott in Berkeley. He's worked on the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, the drug connections, and now he's writing a book with Jonathan Marshall on the Iran-Contra links going back to the 70s. And Jonathan Marshall has gotten out a newsletter, Parapolitics, identifying many of the people involved in working with this Contra-Iran scandal years before it became known as that, and the official day for world awareness is tomorrow. But these people have done a lot of quiet work, and they've written and shared their work with the public. And also David Emery up at KFJC in Niptuck. Dave puts on Radio Free America and One Step Beyond 3 hours a week, almost for 7 years, and they play World Watchers up there on KKUP, KFJC, each station twice a week. And that is the thing that keeps the information flowing out there so people understand these things even before it is officially recognized that they get caught, and understand how these things happen. Now, the value of these things is that when Somebody like Daniel Sheehan files a suit for the Christic Institute where he names defendants such as Albert Hakim, General Secord, who will be the first witness on Monday, General Singlaub, Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, and the Columbia Cocaine Kings, plus a list of other defendants going back to the Bay of Pigs and the old network of the intelligence community. When a suit is filed charging drug running, assassinations, and work with the National Security Council linked right up to Washington, it's important for these groups or attorneys. Now they can reach a computer, they can get indexes of books, they can get transcripts of tapes. They have a team of researchers, not a large army, but big enough, that have stayed with these matters, not easy to understand, complicated, but rewarding. And I really do think that the idealism that Woodrow Wilson talked about is there, because those people I mentioned, and even myself, would never do it if we didn't have a certain amount of idealism. If we were cynical or gave up or thought it was hopeless, none of this would get done. But the very fact that that gavel is going to bang down, and tomorrow, many of you, we get these broadcasts a week later, 4 years later, 5 years later, you can play them back. It's just as timely. That's why they're numbered and dated. But for those of you listening tonight, when that gavel hits that table, that, hopefully, is the end of Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan and all the brahoo and all the lies that they've pulled. And also, it will expose the media who have covered them up, because the responsibility for all this truly isn't Ronald Reagan. I have spoke Reaganese with friends for years here in California and elsewhere. He stayed the same. The growing up had to be with the Congress that gave him the $100 million, the extra money for the Contras, that said Grenada was a wonderful experience, that approved of the bombing of Libya, the Congress and the news media, that lock, stock, and barrel made the phenomena happen. They have to look at themselves and say, where did we miss the boat? It's never too late to do that, and it's going to force a lot of people to ask themselves the question. And sure enough, the gavel's going to bang. Now, May 17th, 1973, that wasn't too many years ago, is when the beginning of the Watergate hearings began. And there are similarities between Watergate and Contragate. I'm not going to go into all of them, but I remember I was at the apartment of Flo Kennedy in San Francisco when the hearings began, and we were so excited. And I was sure, oh, now we're going to get the real tricky-dicky Nixon and all the sleazy things he did, because Sam Ervin sounded so sincere. Well, Sam Ervin didn't get to the bottom of everything, but it opened doors. And then it opened other Senator Frank Church's committee and Pike's committee. And there were a lot of investigations later, and the doors were open. But the things that Sam Ervin said so eloquently, I just want to share three or four sentences with you. The opening statements just made a while back, that was only 14 years ago, and Reagan follows in with the same team and thinks that things can be different. This is Sam Ervin, May 17th, 1973. Today, the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities begins hearings. To the extent in which illegal, improper, and unethical activities were involved in the 1972 presidential campaign. Now, these hearings should absolutely involve the 1980 and 1984 presidential campaign of Ronald Reagan. He stole the election both times, and then Fritz Channel was funding members of Congress to pour the money in to influence voters to control the Congress, so Reagan would have 4 years free with his kind of people voting and approving of what he wants. But being caught in Iran, saying the weapons to Iran, and then with Eugene Hasenfuss landing in Nicaragua and all that ensued, this is complicated enough. But later you will see, in his lifetime or outside of his lifetime, all the chapters and verses of the way he stole the election. There are about seven major categories regarding that. Sam Ervin said, we begin these hearings today in an atmosphere of utmost gravity. The question has been raised in the wake of the June 17th break-in at the time of Watergate about the undergirding of our democracy. And as I say, you'll find similarities in these words, even though the circumstances by which they got caught was different. If the many allegations made to this date are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen, and if these allegations proved to be true, they were seeking to steal, not jewels or money or other property, of the American citizens, but something much more valuable, their most precious heritage, the right to vote in a free election. And this goes into Spitz Channel, influencing the voters also with their multi-million-dollar propaganda. He said, since the day of their arrest, there's been a mood of incredulity that prevailed among the populace, and it is the constitutional duty of that committee then, as now, to expeditiously allay those fears being expressed by the citizens and to establish the factual basis upon which the fears were founded. And as Sam Ervin said, we will be concerned with the integrity of a governmental system designed by men who understood the lessons of the past and who accordingly established a framework of separated governmental power in order to prevent any one branch of the government from becoming dominant over the other. The Founding Fathers have participated in the struggle against arbitrary power, comprehended some eternal truth respecting men in government. They knew that those who are entrusted with power are susceptible to the disease of tyrants, which George Washington described as love of power and the proneness to abuse it. For that reason, they realized, as well as other people, that they're obligated to obey, a truth enunciated by Daniel Webster when he said, whatever government is not a government of laws is a despotism, let it be called what it may. To the end of ensuring a society governed by laws embodied in the Constitution, they went back to the way the Constitution was written with the executive, legislative, and judicial to check the balances of power. And in dealing with the challenges posed by the multitudinous allegations coming out of Watergate, the Select Committee has a task more difficult or more complex than dealing with the intrusion of any one single form of government. And he says if the allegations made in the wake of it are substantiated, there has been a serious subversion of the integrity of the electoral process, and the committee will be obliged to consider the manner in which the subversion affects the continued existence of this nation. Now, in this case of Watergate, Richard Nixon was stealing the election, which he stole, as Ronald Reagan did in 1980-84. In the Contra-Rand affair, Reagan bypassed the elected Congress and took the executive to make the powers of war, of deciding who dies, who lives, and using agencies of the government as his own private army, making them swear to secrecy and so forth. So the Congress, one of those three checks and balances, has no purpose at all, and the judiciary sided with him, Edwin Meese, his best friend, so that there was no judiciary, there was just the executive getting away with all this crap. And Sam Ervin said that the aim of their committee was to provide full and open public testimony in order that the nation could proceed with the healing of the wounds that now affect the body politic. The nation and history itself are watching us. We cannot fail this mission. Now, that sounded great, but they failed the mission because they covered up so much. The system, and this is very important, the system is made to protect itself. You have to understand the game plans by which the system works. Don't have any illusions when the hearings start. The game plans are as objective and clear, except for a few differences, whether you're playing chess or checkers or backgammon. The players make certain moves in certain directions, and they can't go other directions. The system of control in Washington, particularly in Washington with the intelligence community and the CIA and National Security Council, protects itself. The very first agency protected when all this came down was the National Security Council, with John Tower and Brent Scowcroft, formerly of the National Security Council, saying it's a wonderful institution. We had a few bad apples, but it's wonderful. Go with it, you know, and it has to be cleaned out. Just as Woodrow Wilson said in his last speech before he died that there would be another war against Germany, I can tell you now that there will be other scandals in Washington identical to this because they have protected the NSC, and the NSC is where they should go. So given all the other scapegoats who they can kill or do lobotomies or offer prize money or contracts or movies and books, you're still going to see a lot of funny faces in front of the camera, and it's going to be certainly very, very interesting. But don't have any illusions that the NSC got scraped. The NSC can do just about anything it wants, but on the other hand, there will be an alert Congress, I hope, a good group voted in every time we have an election, and an alert group recognizing that their decision-making was wiped out and that they're going to protect it this next time. I'll take a one-minute break and then go on to the Iran-Contra story and give an overview of some of the characters involved. And then, of course, next week we can get back to the details of them and their agencies and how they operate, and simultaneously how they cover up and try to hold the line, giving just as little as they can, but letting some out, because the hearings will let an awful lot out.